I knew it wasn't just the revenue committee.
Now, if you cut off cash flow, Tony, that is in lieu of revenue, right?
Did you learn that in the house?
I learned that sitting at this very desk.
Okay.
Cut it off and it's just...
We're now moving on to public testimony, and we have a few folks signed up here. And if there's anybody else who really wants to talk with us, since this... Do we take public testimony on Wednesday? I guess we do as well.
We have one more round of the first thing on Wednesday.
Okay.
It was on for four
times. We'll get started. Lee Hazelwood? Mm-hmm.
You know, I always say consultants, but I are one nice person who's outstanding in his field, 50 miles from home.
It's a person who knows Washington and tells him what time it is.
Welcome.
Co-chairs and member of the committee, my name is Lee Hazelwood. In my other life, or some of my life, I'm a member now of the Mid-Willamette Valley Senior Service Agency Advisory Council. I have been a member of the Governor's Commission, legislative coordinator under three different governors. That a dollar will buy you a small pop at McDonald's. I have been an elected, Senator Morissette was talking about, I have been an elected official, term limited out. Some people would like to have had that sooner, but my suggestions would be on revenue enhancement, as Senator Corcoran talked about, on the very first page, Mid-Willamette Valley Senior Service Agency Advisory Council met December 4th, quite a while before the other committee hearings were held. This is some of our suggestions. I can read those, $118 million in the Medicaid upper limit money, $82 million in the unallocated master settlement tobacco revenue, $30 million in expansion of video poker to include line games. And I do want to, before I go any further, say that those numbers are fluctuating as you probably heard. $36 million increase in excise tax on beer to the national median, which we are a lot lower than the national median. 14.6 increase excise tax on wine to the national median. 22.8 increase cigarette tax of 10 cents a pack, which will still keep us below the state of Washington. And as you probably read in the paper, they've been picking up people who are taking cigarettes back and forth. And so if we enforce that a little bit more, we'll get more revenue. 7.6 million increase in OLCC markup. I think at the present time, it's somewhere in the neighborhood 103%, move it up to maybe 106 or so. Then Mid-Willamette Valley, I didn't necessarily vote on these, but this is the process, the postponed delay of new programs. $220 million in grades 1 through 5 new reading program. $66 million Oregon Children's Plan screening of firstborn. That brings us to across the board cuts. The remaining 113 at that time, the figure was $710 million we were trying to reach. Approximately 1% of the state budget, every line item and entire budget should be reduced proportionally to achieve the savings. Sorry about that. But then I want to go to page 2. Additional options. I want to repeat again, these numbers are fluctuating because of, I guess, the economy. $140 to $150 million postponed Measure 88. That would take quite a bit of courage on the part of the House and the Senate to do that. I think they can do it. There's $100 to $150 million economic stimulus under consideration by U.S. Congress in federal matching funds for Medicaid, which will help backfill some of that section. That economic stimulus package is on last I heard and tried to get something on it on Sunday night is still being negotiated. $60 million from the Common School Fund, that possibly creates a legal issue. There's $200 million in the Educational Endowment Fund. I think that started in Senator Gordon Smith, 15% of the lottery fund. $115 million if Congress passes House Bill 3090. That's an economic security fund and possible Oregon shares, $115 million of that. And still, again, that depends on the House and Senate getting their heads together. $500 million, a possible sale of Elliott Forest, and part of that's in Lane and Douglas County.
You understand that we're going to the Common School Fund?
That would very possible go to the Common School one. Thank you.
It's in Coosa.
But that would free up.
Not Lane.
That would free up. If,
Lane goes out to the coast, so it may pick up a little piece.
$45 to $6 million. Senate Bill 1149 was passed by the 1999 Oregon Legislature, and that's the Energy Trust Fund. That could be tapped. $75 to $159 million, depending on which formula you use. Eliminate all state positions unfilled for a period of 6 months. There are some at the present time that have not been filled, but there is possibly money to do that. And then I get down to some that, me personally, I thought I'd put these in because I don't want to say this is seniors against kids or so forth, but $7 million senior prescription drug assistance, which was voted on by the legislature last session.
But, Lee, these are things that the Mid-Willamette Valley senior service...
No, I said the first page is what Mid-Willamette Valley.
Yeah.
Mine are the additional options.
I wonder how come they wanted to tax themselves on some of this. Okay.
If you,
I mean, this is
Madam Co-Chair, if you look down at the bottom, it says Lee Hazelwood, Senior Advocate. This is my list. $7 million to local mental health planning service. There's money there. $4.3 million the TANF, not TAMF, but TANF carry forward. That's temporary assistance needy families, and that's a crucial program. But $2.5 million redirect unused and unexpired Jobs Plus education account. $2.6 million Jobs Plus elimination. $0.5 million STARS teen pregnancy prevention program. And my granddaughter helped me do this list, and she said, Grandpa, you can't put that in there. I said, sorry, okay. A $0.275 million retired senior volunteer program. That's laying out there someplace. And I have food for thought. And some of us, due to the way we look, we're around here when we had a Democratic controlled Senate and House, Republican governor, who put in a surtax on personal income tax and corporate tax. At the present time, lowest interest rates at present time could possibly save billions of dollars on state contracts. Interest rates are dropping dramatically, and these contracts are worked on. I know ODOT testified the other day that they would probably get additional $67 million because of this.
Madam Chair.
Senator Corcoran.
So, Lee, answer the question about how prudent it is to go after, back on your first page, revenue enhancements, to go after all of the unallocated MUPL money and all of the master settlement tobacco revenue. I mean, we're looking at a $1 billion hole at least for the next biennium. And was there discussion about that? Or?
Yeah, there was, Senator Corcoran, but I do want to point out an additional page on additional options. And I didn't go into the surtax. I have a total there of $1,279,000,000 without the first page.
That's right. So your point is we could exercise those other options and not have to use the entire MUPL? And
we could. Those are the possibilities.
Thank you.
But I do want to point out that Medicaid upper limit money is, there's some talk of that slowly phasing out, but I have information with me that's going to extend to the year 2010. So, and that's still a congressional thing. And I do want to, a favorite program of mine, as all of you well know, I know I've talked to a number of you, I do want to mention Oregon Project Independence. There is a fellow who's been on the radio talking about a lot of these things are decreased on top of increase. But OPI was only funded to the 1999 level, no increase. So I would like to add this as a collection of tombstone epithets that our language man has added. It's a favorite expression of mine. Remember, friend, as you walk by, As you are now, so once was I. As I am now, so you will be, so be prepared to follow me. And wait, that's now beneath the foregoing a passerby allegedly scrawled, to follow you, I'm not content until I find out which way you went. So this is a favorite expression of mine, so if there's any questions you might, but these are all possibilities that so far in a week or 10 days, I have not heard anybody talk about the possibility of revenue enhancement. Sorry about that, Senator Corcoran, but I have not heard about people. People are talking about the cuts that are being made, what can happen to schools and so forth. But one question was never asked by legislators were, how did your area vote on Measure 5 and Measure 47 / 50? And I did happen to be a council person when that hit our city. And so it's a question that maybe should be asked.
Madam Chair,
Senator Dunn,
I might just comment following Lee's little poem there at the end. Yesterday in church, our pastor had a prayer, but they added one that wasn't in the original prayer. And right at the end, they added, it is better to find solutions than to point fingers. Afterwards, I asked the pastor, I said, is that meant for any particular senator sitting in your congregation? And he smiled. But I think that Lee, you met that in a sense by identifying things that also would hit you, and I think that you are to be commended for that.
Well, Madam Chair, if I might, just one more thing. I do have a brother that lives in Florida, and he has a tendency to give me the ribbing from time to time. He sent me a clipping that delaying deep cuts in health and social service programs due to the fact that the state of Florida depends primarily on state tax. They lopped $300 million from education. I sent him a note back. I only said two things, no way, and signed my name.
Are there any other questions? Senator Ferrioli.
On the Elliott State Forest, wouldn't it be better, Lee, not to sell the real estate, but keep the forest and possibly accelerate the timber harvesting?
Unfortunately, Senator Ferrioli, the committee asked for suggestions. I can't answer that one, even though I could talk about the Tillamook Forest that's ready to be harvested, but there's a number of different things, which would wind up in a lot of it in the Common School Fund.
No, it goes to the taxing districts in the area in which it's harvested.
Okay.
And the Department of Forestry.
Okay.
Same with the Elliott.
Well, the Elliott goes to the Common School Fund. Yeah, it's all dedicated money.
Mm-hmm.
Good job.
Question?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Bob Castagna.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Bob Castagna, representing the Oregon Catholic Conference. Before I begin, I want to thank you for your patience and endurance and attentiveness that you displayed last week and continue today, and I know on Wednesday as you prepare your recommendations. You've done a tremendous service to the people of the state in listening to all these proposals and your fellow colleagues in terms of listening to the testimony on the proposed budget balancing or budget prioritization. As we testified last week before the Senate Committee on Budget Rebalance and the House Committee on Budget Prioritization, we mentioned to the members that while the decisions that you have before you are economic decisions, while they are public policy decisions, and while they are certainly political decisions, they are also essentially and primarily moral decisions, and that they prospect of looking at the potential budget reductions that have been recommended by the various departments. And as those potential reductions are meshed with the available revenues in this committee's work, we come before you with a basic appeal. And the basic appeal is to ask you to provide more in the way of resources so that the cuts that have been proposed do not have to be visited on the recipients of the services and the people of the state of Oregon. When I was hired in 1984 by then Archbishop Cornelius Power, he gave me one fundamental charge. And he said, Bob, I'd like you to go to Salem and advocate for the common good. And that has been repeated to me by my successor archbishops and presidents of the Oregon Catholic Conference, including Archbishop Glasney. So we're here asking for the common good and asking for additional resources. We are not attached to any one particular resource proposal or revenue-raising proposal, but we see the need for additional resources. One which we would suggest for serious consideration, despite potential political difficulties, is postponing or delaying the legal effectiveness of Measure 88. Between the federal government's rebate, the 2% kicker, there comes a time when one must ask, how many revenue reductions or tax decreases can we afford in the face of services which are needed by the people? Be they human services by the vulnerable poor, or be they the educational services of the children of the state. And even though the Catholic Church has its own educational system, we are also supporters of quality public education for the children of the state. There is one revenue proposal or policy item that has been discussed that we would like to go on definite record in opposition to, and that's the expansion of video poker into online gaming. There was an Attorney General's report a few years ago talking about the number of people who are addicted, and we definitely want to urge the policymakers in this state, be they at the executive or the legislative branches of government, to not move in that direction. Interesting to note on that issue, when you looked at the proposed reductions in the Department of Human Services budget, which was arrayed in 2% increments, each of the first level of the 2%, second 2%, third, fourth, and fifth, dealt with lottery reductions and reductions in services to those afflicted with gambling addiction. It would be a tremendous anomaly if we expanded lottery and video poker to include online gaming and at the same time suffered cuts in the Department of Human Services budget dealing with people who are addicted to gambling. So we would urge both branches of government not to move in the direction of online gaming. When we heard the testimony last week in the Department of Human Services budget, I also testified to the House that the potential cuts there reverse almost 20 years of advocacy. We go back to 1985 in my first session, advocating on behalf of the Oregon Catholic Conference. We advocated successfully for the restoration of public assistance for two-parent unemployed families. That program would propose to be eliminated. General assistance proposed to be eliminated. Emergency assistance proposed to be eliminated. These cuts are so deep as to touch the conscience of anyone who would read that list, say this is unconscionable in terms of the direction of public policy. But those unconscionable cuts can only be avoided if the resources are enhanced in order to balance that state budget. As you and we both realize, lives hang in the balance with these cuts. And the only way to avoid it, from our perspective, is to produce additional resources. The churches and the charities can supplement what government does. We cannot replace government programs. Our numbers aren't there just in terms of the numbers of participants and members of churches, and certainly the contributions aren't there. And churches and charities participate in the same economy as everyone else. And if the state's revenues are down, then charitable contributions and church contributions are down as well. We don't want to see there be a human services or education disaster visit the state. But the only way we think that that's going to be avoided is if additional resources are produced through the variety of ways that you have available to you to try to achieve that end. I want to thank you for your time. Thank you for your hard work as legislators. We don't envy your position. You're in our prayers, and we'll be there advocating.
Other questions? Senator Dunn.
Well, we've had those figures too, but I can't recall. What's the What would be the dollar amount on ballot measure 88 that Bob was talking about?
Senator Duncan, we have re-estimated that recently. Our initial estimate was $159 million, but that has decreased because the base is declining, mm-hmm. given the reduction of the forecast. So I believe our estimate is right about $140 million would be the impact from not just, that would be from postponing it 2 years. That's roughly a year and a half of revenue because it becomes effective for the 2002 tax year.
2002. So you would, okay, so you would not, it would be the April of 2000.
Right. You would, if you were to postpone it to 2004, it would be $140 million increase in revenue. Mm-hmm. Most of that revenue, we think, that will affect the revenue stream not until the spring of 03, because it's a maximum of $180 per filer, so it's likely to show up in lower refunds or higher refunds or lower estimated payments with the April 15 reconciliation. But it's effective for the 2002 tax year.
One additional reason, if I might add, for considering the postponement of the legal effectiveness of Measure 88 is that as you are contemplating the reduction of services to the most needy in the state, Measure 88, at least as I recall the revenue charts that were generated by the Legislative Revenue Office, show that 80% of the benefits flow to those with incomes above $50,000. So that while we would be cutting services, we would be giving a tax break to those at the middle and upper ends of the income charts.
I'm sure I wonder if Paul would like to respond to that.
Senator Duncan, the way the federal subtraction works is we now have taxpayers to subtract, meaning that they don't have to itemize. They can subtract up to $3,000.
Mm-hmm.
So what this does is just increase that from 3 to 5. So the people that are affected are going to be those that currently now are subtracting more than 3,000.
Mm-hmm.
So that tends to be with a... The threshold on that varies by type of filer. For a single filer, it's anywhere from $25,000 to $30,000. For families, it can be in the neighborhood of $40,000 to $50,000 when you have two dependents before you get over that 3,000 threshold.
Other questions?
Thank you. Thank you very much.
We should distribute this chart that Ed did. I asked for this information earlier. By $10,000 increments, and you can see where it accrues.
Mm-hmm.
The same with the kicker, Madam Chair. I can't remember the exact numbers, but something like 65% of the kicker goes to the top quintile. 65% of kicker benefit.
And we can make that available to committee members. Rich Peppers.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Rich Peppers. I'm representing the SEIU Local 503 OPEU. And I just want to say at the outset that I recognize the significance of there being a Revenue Options Committee on the Senate side, and I appreciate it and appreciate the chance to come before you. And recognize also that we're getting on in time, and I'll try to make this relatively speedy. I'd like to join with also some of the comments from the people who've just come before me in saying that we see great need, and that's why we're here. We believe that the cuts that are pending, if the entire $720 or $900 million shortfall is taken, will be horrendous, and therefore, we're here before the committee to propose some solutions to you. And one of the first things I'd like to say is that you had before you on Friday, I believe, the representative of the Oregon Education Association, Lori Wimmer, and our organization, I and our organization, joined with her in her flyer or proposals that were laid out before you. We've been talking with the OEA for a long time beforehand and are still in conversation with them, and we believe that the list that you had presented to you by her, I didn't attach it again to my testimony, but I could get you copies of it again. That's a list that is fully worthy of consideration by this committee. But I also have a few additional comments to make. And if the committee, and this gets to my second point, if the committee believes that either syntaxes or other proposals on that list are that they lack merit and that other alternatives should be pursued, one way of looking at that, we believe, should be to recognize that there's a Nobel laureate economist report that has just come out recently, and I believe David Williams will be bringing an actual summary of the report with him when he comes forward. But that emphasizes the preferred way to go about raising additional revenue, if that's the decision of the legislature, is to do it by focusing on the higher income groups, and that will result in the least negative effect on an already a stressed economy, because people in the higher incomes tend to not be as immediate in their spending of any additional income they have. And so the money that would be that they would have at their disposal tends not to get turned around and put back into the economy as much as the proportions that people at the lower incomes give. There are several alternatives for how to go about doing just that. One of them is to perhaps do what was done in the 80s, which is the possibility of a temporary surcharge on the income tax, which was a solution that came out of that recession. Another possibility would be to look at a more targeted way of perhaps reclaiming or recovering some of the kicker revenues that went to upper income taxpayers only, not across the board, but as a way to, one alternative way to recover some of that additional money. Or possibly looking at some tax expenditures that mostly benefit upper income taxpayers. And so there are different ways about fulfilling that principle of focusing the additional revenue-raising alternatives at higher-income people. Our next consideration for the committee we'd like to say is that it probably would make sense to disconnect from the federal tax code so as not to let the problem get worse that you're already facing. Several people have already addressed the economic stimulus package that's working its way through Congress. We believe there will be tax cuts in those, and those should stand at the federal level, but they should not be passed through automatically, at least, to the Oregon tax code. Otherwise, we'll be facing additional problems here, and we'll probably have our hands full already with the problems we're already facing. And finally, from a long-range perspective, we suggest reversing or at least stopping the long-term trend in Oregon's tax system of shifting tax responsibility from an even 50-50 balance between business and individuals in the early 90s to today's 40-60 or worse proportions. And there are, again, many ways to do this. I add this to our testimony simply as a long-range perspective. We realize during a recession it is an unlikely time that we would see much action on this front, but as a long-range orientation, we believe it's important to bear in mind that there have been trends in the tax system overall. Some proposals have come up even during the last session for perhaps addressing some of the stability issues that arise out of that. And I would just like to commend to the committee that they that you all hopefully keep this in mind as we work our way through this recession and into the next period. And that pretty much concludes my testimony. If you have any questions, I'll be happy to try and answer them.
Are there questions?
I'm sure.
Senator Corcoran.
When you talk about disconnect from the federal government, Rich, would, for example, the fact that mortgage interest paid on secondary residences now is deductible, would that be one area? That's a 755, well, both owner-occupied primary residences and secondary residences together, the deductibility amounts to $755 million for this biennium. I don't know what percentage of that is second homes, but would you support that disconnect?
Madam Chair, Senator Corcoran, I would say that fits probably under two of my points. If there is federal legislation pending that would change the interest deduction, then we would argue that you hopefully would look at disconnecting in that respect, because it will worsen the problem here in Oregon if that gets passed through or added to our tax code, any additional deductions. I'm not sure if that's the case or not, then look to your staff to perhaps give us that information. But there's also another point, which is that, excuse me, my second point, if you were, as a committee, considering ways to possibly target tax or revenue raisers towards higher income people, one way to do that might be to look at that existing expenditure, tax expenditure, and cap it instead of at a million, I think it is, cap it at a lower number, or not have it apply as much to second residences, or, you know, there are different ways of going about doing that without eliminating it altogether. It's a gradual reduction rather than full-fledged elimination.
One more question. So we talked about the current expenditures and the disconnect, but also in the last session, one of the things we did is pass some revenue measures that part of their selling point was that they wouldn't affect this biennium, but they have a strong consequence on future biennium. One of them was the capital gains, and that was vetoed. But the other one was, I think it was 2281. Is that right, Paul? That was the single factor.
Apportionment formula.
Apportionment formula. That has a $62 million revenue impact in the 03-05 biennium, 65 in the 05-07. How do you view those kind of tax policies in terms of your fourth point?
Madam Chair, Senator Corcoran, I think that they fall into that category in the fourth point. I think it's my fourth point. They do continue the trend that we've seen for some time of changing the responsibility for tax, the tax burden overall, and the proportion paid by individuals versus businesses. I would say that on that particular bill that you mentioned, the single sales factor bill, or whatever it's called, that we argued during the session that there was that this would worsen the problem that we already knew then during the session that we would be facing. There were some underlying theories about whether a change in the sales factor would actually wind up stimulating the economy and improve the situation in the state economically. There were pros and cons and people testifying on both sides of that particular argument. My perspective, our organization's perspective, had been during the session to say that if people want to take a chance with and explore this possibility that a change in the calculation could result in improved or increased location of business in Oregon, then at least do it in a revenue-neutral way. Figure out a way to change the factor, but use bridging financing or bridging revenue to get us from point A to point B 5 years down the road, when, in theory at least, more business would be coming into the state and make up for the losses that we will suffer in the meantime in the budget.
The final question is the other bill that we passed that I'm not sure, I wanted to ask Paul if this is even germane anymore because of the change in the budget picture, but that was the change in the schedules on unemployment compensation. Or does that only, because it only impacts the trust fund, it doesn't affect general fund at all?
Senator Corcoran, that does not affect the general fund. You think back on that, there's a series of schedules, and what that did was lower the rates. The fund is designed to automatically adjust when unemployment gets to certain levels. So it's a lower rate, but it's a lower sliding scale that will vary with the unemployment.
Right.
And it's designed to account for historical experience, which would be included in what we've seen so far.
Thanks.
I'm glad I didn't have to try and deal with that question.
Any other questions? Thank you very
Thank
much.
Thank you.
Michelle Beister? I have the sheets.
That's the class warfare sheet, what I fondly call it. I've got another one on the kicker. Class warfare, too.
Yeah. Yeah, it is.
Unfortunately, Madam Chairman, there's no Oregonian reporter because they've left the room to report those comments.
All the Republicans are here, Madam Chairman, I believe, but only some of the Democrats.
That's true. That's true.
Good afternoon, co-chairs and members of the committee. I'm Michelle Deister with the League of Oregon Cities. And first of all, let me say that I really appreciated the discussion that this committee had with the counties, the assessors, and the tax collectors this morning, because I really think that it illustrates the idea that the economic health of the state and the economic health of local communities are very much connected. And I appreciate your comments and your understanding of that basic concept. As you'll see, it's really the underpinning here of my written testimony. Let me also be very upfront by saying that it's highly likely that my testimony will be a disappointment to Senator Corcoran.
I know, I was just going to go take a break. I read it. I'll stay.
Thank you, Senator.
You're the Democrats,
right?
As the name of this committee indicates, the legislature and particularly the Senate recognizes the importance of having revenue options, particularly in times of budgetary difficulties. And as I said, you know, there is some understanding that the economic health of local communities and the state are connected. In terms of city services that are provided, we believe that we provide the services and the infrastructure that businesses need to grow and thrive and provide employment, and that other services, such as libraries and parks, are quality of life services that help to attract a stable and educated workforce, which in turn is beneficial for the state. As you well know, and as was discussed this morning, local governments and communities have been struggling with budget difficulties for quite a while now, and any economic downturn in the state level also impacts local communities as well. And you know, some of the examples of what cities have been trying to do to mitigate the circumstances are outlined here in my written testimony. I won't go into them, but I just wanted to provide those so that you folks had a sense of the fact that we are experiencing those issues, and we have been dealing with them, and we have been having to make some very difficult decisions. As you know, having funding options in such circumstances as these is very important, and I would submit to you that preserving local funding options allows cities to help fulfill our part of the state and local partnership, and helps to solve local problems at the local level before they have an impact, you know, further up the line, or before we come to the legislature asking for help to solve some of these issues. So therefore, as you consider possible revenue options, please be aware of this fact, and please consider that we would specifically endorse those options that don't preempt, undercut, or compete with traditionally local sources of revenue. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Looks like there aren't any.
There you go. Thank you very much.
Stephen Williams.
Good afternoon, co-chairs, members of the committee. My name is David Williams, representing the Oregon School Employees Association. OSE is a classified union representing nearly, I guess now it's more than 19,000 classified employees in Oregon's public K-12, ESDs, community colleges, Head Start, Parks and Rec, and a library district. Thank you for giving me an opportunity to talk to you today. Like other speakers, I do want to applaud the Senate's efforts in actually having this committee and considering revenue options. And the first part of my testimony here talks about the expediency of considering those revenue options, and I don't need to belabor that point. as evidenced by the fact that this committee exists. Belabor it a little bit, I think that poll after poll has shown that Oregonians support our public services. They support education, public safety, health, the numerous vital things that make Oregon what it is, that give it the quality of life that we all hold so dear. Further, I think Oregonians understand that it takes revenue in order to keep those public services around and to preserve them, especially during times of economic recession. So I would urge you to not simply consider that the public doesn't have the taste for revenue increases, because I believe they do. You have, as throughout the days of testimony in this committee, seen various revenue options. My colleagues from OPU and OEA have presented you with lists of revenue options, I would like to reaffirm those, and attached to my testimony is a very strikingly similar list of options as was presented by OEA. And so I won't go into those individually, other than to say if any of you had any questions, I'd be happy to answer those. But I would like to take a moment to step back from a larger perspective. And when we talk about solving the current revenue problem, obviously OSCA advocates a revenue solution to that problem. And we, in conjunction with several groups in coalition, have put together some criteria when you look at those revenue options that we feel help to apply and decide if revenue options are expedient and useful. The first of those is obviously using one-time funds and available revenues. I think this speaks directly to tobacco settlement funds and MUFL money. We feel it's imperative, just as a prudent family would dip into savings during times of revenue decrease, it's important for the state to dip into those resources as well to help close the gap. The second criteria is that any revenue option has to shrink the hole, obviously. I think right now when we're dealing with a short-term or temporary fix, we don't have necessarily the luxury of considering maybe worthy revenue-neutral taxes and structure changes at this moment, because it doesn't get us to a solution to the problem at hand. My third point is that any solution has to have a minimal negative impact, and this speaks to the report that Rich Peppers mentioned. It was titled Budget Cuts Versus Tax Increases at the State Level by two fellows, one being the 2001 Nobel Laureate for Economics, and the other being a senior fellow at the Brookings Institute. And I have attached a copy of that report as well for your pleasure reading. And I think that what that speaks to is that any revenue has to be implemented in such a way that it does not increase the negative recession that we're in. Well, the recession is negative, I guess. It does not increase the recession that, well, it's a judgment call. I suppose it could be positive in some respect. But it does not increase the recession that we're in. To the effect that a heavy tax burden on low-income families would decrease the amount of money that they have to put back into the economy, because at the lower end of the scale, your margins are so much tighter. You have so much less savings, so therefore your any decrease in your expendable income is directly taken out of the economy and therefore hurts the economy. My fourth point is what I want to transition into to talk about in the rest of my testimony, is that in all of this, we can't forget that there is a larger structural problem that we've been facing now for a decade, the impending problems of an unstable revenue system that some of you, my colleagues would have me say, some of you have been up there since I was in diapers. I don't want to say that because I don't want to accentuate my youth, but there is.
Madam Chairman, it's the condition that is self-curing.
I was not speaking to either of the co-chairs, I might add. This problem, I think that we in Oregon have been blessed, and I think nationwide, by a decade of unprecedented economic growth that has simply masked the problems that have been building. We have a revenue system that is plagued by two things. One, it is an increasing shift in tax burden from a balanced structure of corporate versus individual taxpayers to a system that is heavily reliant on individual taxpayers. And in addition to that, we all know that the three-legged stool metaphor. We have been increasingly shifting away from a tax system that is broadly based and balanced on multiple revenue streams to one that is based on income tax, a tax that many consider one of the most volatile taxes when it comes to a recession. When you have a recession, income goes down, and therefore so do income taxes. It's fairly logical. So it is time, I think, that as we consider short-term or temporary solutions to this problem, we need to begin to take on the task of solving this larger problem that Oregon is facing. We all know the projections for the next biennium, upwards of $1.2 or more billion dollars. So solving a $720 million shortfall is going to help us now, but it doesn't get us anywhere next biennium. We have to continue to look beyond where we are at this point. We have to work to solve that fragile revenue system that we exist in. And I think that is one of the more bold tasks that you as legislators can take on. And I don't envy your position. It's not, if I had the quick fix, I could pass it out to you and we could all go home and, you know, that we'd all be fine and Jim Mayer could write it up in the Oregonian and, you know, there'd be no problems. But it doesn't exist and it's going to take a lot of hard work. And I applaud you in starting that effort, and I also want to encourage you to continue those efforts now and in the next legislative session, that we need to come to a broad, larger solution to this problem. Thank you, co-chairs.
Are there questions? No. Thank you.
Thank you.
Kathy Cole? Oh, good. I need to insult somebody before they get up to the podium.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, for allowing me to speak.
Well, thank you for coming.
Well, I do appreciate every one of you legislators and all the time you give and all the work you do and all the horrendous study that you've got to do now. I just have to say that I think you're kind of derelict in your real duty to follow the Oregon Constitution, Article 15, that says the legislature...
Before you finish that, can I get you to identify yourself for the record?
Oh, I'm sorry. Kathy Thole from Grand Ronde.
Yeah, you can choose.
Fair enough. Okay. I remember one time I testified. I know you were there. And it was kind of an impromptu testimony, and I was breathless. And I got done, and I said, I'm going to die. And the chairman says, well, don't do it before we adjourn. So anyway, I didn't die.
You're feeling better today.
Yes, that's
true.
So what I'm talking about is this large sucking sound that is taking our economy, and you all know what it is, and it's the casinos, particularly the high-stakes gambling. And in Article 15 of our Constitution, it says the legislature shall prevent the operation of casinos in Oregon. Now, when the tribes just had gaming, you know, Class 1 and Class 2, that wasn't a casino. But when it went to high stakes with the tribal state compact with the governors, that makes it a casino. And the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act of October 17th, 1988 says it has to be compact with the state. Well, the governor isn't the state, and our Constitution speaks to you guys' responsibility. And the first compact with our casino in Grand Ronde was 93, and the second one 97, and now it's 2001, and so another one is probably in the making. And so if you could involve yourselves in that, we might get better than 6%. You know, the 6% doesn't really go to our community. It buys somebody a seat at Senator Wyden and Senator Smith and Representative Hulliet, et cetera, in their offices. But another thing I want to say, I think at least half of the lottery money should go to human resources. I mean, actually, the lottery and the gambling takes money away from the families. And so I think the lottery revenue should go to the families, you know.
This committee is charged with coming up with possibilities for raising additional revenue.
Right. Okay, then let me get to my last point.
Okay.
The thing you have in front of you is something I just got in the mail today. It's called a reservation report, and if you look down where the arrow is, you'll see that the Indian casinos are going to have to pay federal income tax. Well, years ago, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that it is constitutional for states to tax casinos that originated in a state when they started with a state incorporation. And I think that the state should tax the reservations, and that's why I'm suggesting the tribal state compact that you guys involve yourselves in the rewriting of this and get a tax from them.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Senator Morrison.
Thank you. That's what I'm looking at, and I really appreciate your comments, and I'm going to check that out.
Thank you.
Particularly the part about the feds, the federal income tax and the possibility of a state income tax, regardless of compacts. I think it's terrible that we're losing that source of revenue.
Oh, it is just absolutely tremendous.
Yeah, that's a good, excellent point.
Thank you.
Are there any questions? No.
Thank you very much.
Very much.
And I'm not going to die.
Oh, good. I'm glad. Okay, is there anyone else who would like to testify? No? Well, that concludes our public testimony today, and it also concludes our agenda. Paul, we're back on Wednesday, 9 a.m.
9 a.m. on Wednesday. We have, at the beginning of the meeting, just a final invitation for public testimony for anyone that couldn't make it last Wednesday or today. And then from there, it's a deliberation on the part of the committee about the report and the elements that should go in that report.
Okay. Other comments before we finish? No?
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Morrison.
Good job.
Thank you.
But that doesn't mean that the other co-chair did not do a good job. You didn't talk as much as he did.
You're just glad because you're getting out before 4 o'clock in the afternoon.
But he'll have his chance.
Yes, he will. All right, well, with that, we're adjourned.